Welcome back to the Outsource Accelerator podcast. Today, I am talking to Tim Burgess. He is the co-founder of Shield Geo. They are based in Australia. They're a professional employer organization, and this field is really getting me excited right now. Shield Geo offers, and we're going to talk about this in the podcast, but basically global employment solutions and anything that involves global employment, I just find really fascinating at the moment. Just so much potential and hope if the entire world becomes one globalized workforce. There's a lot of attention on this sector now, which of course has been championed and catalyzed by the remote work and the whole COVID work from home thing. So it's a fascinating area that I was hoping to learn more about with Tim Burgess. And of course, I did exactly that. It was a great conversation, and I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn something too. If you want any of the show notes, as always, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. Enjoy. This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you're already outsourcing, about to start, or somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your outsourcing practices. We list over 700 outsourcing suppliers on our website, host this leading outsourcing podcast, and have over 5,000 pages of content. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. We offer everything from light brokerage, co-managed services, through to fully managed solutions. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Mention that you're a podcast listener, and we will give you special attention plus a 10% discount. This is for a limited time only. Go to outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. I started off the conversation with Tim by asking him what Shield Geo is and how it helps globalized employment.
Sure. Thanks, Derek. And thanks for having me on. So at Shield Geo, we're what we call an employer of record service. It's sometimes called International PEO, or Professional Employment Organization. We thought when we started the business it was going to be called a global employer organization, which is where we put GEO in the name, but never quite caught on, unfortunately. And what we do is employ international workers on behalf of companies where they're unable to do it themselves. And so the most common scenario is an American company wants to hire a salesperson in Japan. They don't want to set up an entity to employ one person in Japan. But they can use us. We've got a local entity. We take the person on as our employee, and we handle all of the local employment, payroll, tax, compliance, and the administration related to that. You know, we don't get involved in the day-to-day work relationship at all. We just make sure that everything's done legally.
Great. So that's the foundation. And look, I find this such an exciting area, because what I think we're seeing with the advent of all this, the noise about remote work and distributed teams, and then, of course, the catalyst of COVID, which has really sort of forced every company to embrace or adopt remote work in some fashion. There's also the digital nomad movement, and there's just generally a lot more mobility around the globe, both, you know, kind of tourism and work. So I find this as regulations and infrastructure generally sort of lag in catching up, and there's a lot of work going around the globe without really a proper regulatory environment. And I'd sort of suggest that Shield Geo is one of the providers now that can help with all of that infrastructure. So there's no real question there. But, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of the trends of employment and how Shield Geo fits in with that?
Gee, it's a big question. I mean, I think you're right. We're going through a really sort of tectonic shift in terms of how work is structured. And the thing that I love about it is the notion of flexibility. and a greater disbursement of opportunity. I think the idea that you have to be tethered to a particular location or a desk in order to be able to do a job, you know, during particular hours with somebody watching you for a huge number of jobs is just, it's just not true. And not only not true, it's actually counterproductive. And then, you know, further than that, with remote working, we've been seeing this for a while in terms of global employment, you know, with the infrastructure around the internet, with the advances in terms of sort of global level of communication, with the number of people around the world who can speak English as a business language, or, you know, or speak a multitude of languages, there's a huge pool of talent that's looking for opportunities and not always able, their needs are not always able to be addressed by the local employment opportunities. So the idea that they can now access a broader range of employers and companies to use their services, and that companies can do the same, I think is fantastic. It couldn't be happier with that as an outcome. To your point about the legal aspects, it's a big challenge. It's a huge challenge. And, you know, I think there's two things. One is that employment regulations were created in a lot of countries. They were created in a different era. You know, I was looking once at the employment regulations in Kenya, and there's regulations about how much water needs to be made available to an employee during the day. Mm. And that's because historically, a lot of the work that happened there was farm work, and it was important that people were hydrated, you know, important that people were able to survive doing that job. But it's still in the employment legislation, even today. And, you know, variations of that are all over the place around factory work, around industrial work, which is
in the Philippines, actually, there's a rice allowance. So every employee still gets a rice allowance included within their employment. So, yeah, it is. It's funny, all these regional kind of historic streams through the regulation. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then I think the one aspect is this sort of historical. And then the other is that the governments have to legislate generally, are legislating against bad behavior. You know, they're legislating to protect the most vulnerable, and rightly so. You know, that's their job, and we need them to do that. So it can be challenging at times when, as a government or as a regulator, I would imagine, you know, I don't have that job luckily, but I'm imagining it would be difficult when, on the one hand, you've got to deal with like a sweatshop where they're trying to, you know, work people 16 hours a day and monitor their every movement and not let them go to the bathroom. And then on the other hand, you've got companies who are putting, sleep pods and, you know, cafeterias and, you know, on-site healthcare and childcare and all this sort of stuff. And you've got to try and make rules that apply to all of it. It must be impossible.
Yeah, it's quite a quilt work, isn't it? Even within the Philippines, the outsourcing industry is, you know, pretty much a golden goose for the economy. There's strong labor protection rules and laws in the Philippines to look after not only the outsourcing workers, but every worker generally, you know, and of course, that's absolutely fantastic. But then next to the outsourcing offices where they commonly would have sleeping pods, you've got people sort of toiling in the street, the hard labor people, the factory workers that don't have even, you know, a sort of fraction of the, I think, rights and net benefit of employment that different sectors do, even within the same economy of the same country. So I can imagine, you know, if you look at a global perspective, it's hard to really line up all of the dots and standards, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And then there's also sort of ideological differences. You know, if you look at America, and it looking at it from an Australian perspective, you know, I'm based in Australia, which Australia sort of, I think it pretends that it's a capitalist country when actually it's pretty socialist. You know, there's a very good safety net in Australia, and the protections are pretty high. And then you look at America, where you can get fired for no reason, with no explanation, in the minute. You know, you're not even allowed to go back to your desk. They usher you out on the street with a security guard. And so these things are very deeply embedded from a cultural perspective in terms of how societies feel they should treat each other, how the societies are constructed. And that comes through in the legislation. You know, so the Philippines, for example, is very much based around hierarchy, as I understand it. You know, we've got a decent-sized team in the Philippines. Hierarchy and the sort of familial culture. You know, it's about your family, your team, your region, and these sort of things layer in tightly knit groups. And I think that that also influences how employment is viewed.
Yeah, and it's difficult to unpick all of the influences in employment and employees and regulations. And when, you know, as we evolve, and it has become a fad, and I think you're in a, you know, fortunate position to be riding an incredible wave of, you know, there's just so much attention on remote work now, on the potential of remote work, distributed workforces, globalized employment. But is it really happening? I mean, we mentioned earlier Matt Mullenweg of Atomic or WordPress, which is probably, you know, one of the biggest ambassadors for remote work. And he has, you know, about 1,500 people. But how, you know, do you think that he is running a sort of truly compliant organization, or do you think that he's really just kind of winging it? And, you know, it amazes me in another sort of segue that in the Philippines, you know, you'll have a lot of people, a lot of employers who are fully compliant with their employment in their home country, yet they come to the Philippines, they just sort of pay them cash. They have to sort everything out themselves. There's no employment contract. There's not even contract law involved. They're definitely not employed. They're not getting HMO. And they don't see that as, like, they see that as the standard, not as a sort of slightly dodgy option. You know, and it's funny the different perspectives that different people have in terms of, you know, sure, we need to be fully compliant with employment and our employees in our home country. But if you go offshore, then it's completely free agent.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the analogy that I come back to is the idea of sort of how you act as a tourist. You know, and so if you go into a country, are you influenced by the way that people dress, by their tipping culture, by the level of politeness or impoliteness? Do you moderate your behavior in order to be respectful of the local traditions? Why are companies any different? Companies should behave the same way. If you go into a country in order to employ people from that country or do business in that country or, you know, transact or benefit in some way from your interaction with that country, then, you know, it's not just a, hey, here's some cash, see you later. You know, that's all we need to do here in order to have any sort of, you know, impact. I don't think, I'm not saying that my view is for everybody or that even my view is right, but I think it helps to try to be sensitive and try and understand what the expectations are and then try to match them. You know, we deal with this stuff in our company all the time. And there was once somebody who, it was an employee in South Korea. She was working in a team of people in South Korea. Her manager was in the US. And they're employed through us. And I got a call that that this employee had been dismissed, that they were upset, that there was some risk. And so I rang her up. And I found out that she had been told that she'd lost her job, not by us, who were her actual employer, who are the ones who have to actually deliver it, the message, not by her line manager, who was in the US, but by one of the people in her team in Korea who happened to actually be a peer. So it wasn't a subordinate to her, it wasn't her manager, it was one of her colleagues. And she was so deeply hurt by that. And I'm not an expert on Korean culture by any stretch of the imagination, but the way she explained it to me, and she said it over and over again, so I could tell that this was the big issue. She said, you know, they're not my manager, they're my colleague. I was told by my colleague, you know, it's embarrassing. I was humiliated. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't, you know, and in that situation where you lose your job, your emotions are all over the place. It's happened to me and it was awful. But the wound to her wasn't so much that she'd lost her job. She knew that it wasn't a good fit. She knew that she wasn't meeting the expectations of the company and the way they'd set her up. But the thing that was really bothering her, and the thing that was going, you know, if we got into a bigger problem, the reason for it was going to be that it was handled with no concept of what you should do in that country, in that circumstance, in order to treat people in the way that they expect.
Gosh, it's complicated, isn't it? Look, yeah. I think if you zoom out a million miles, the concept to me is just so clear that, you know, we live on a planet with about 8 billion people. And as soon as we can have a globalized workforce, then there's huge network effects there. And we sort of break down the borders and the barriers. There's a lot more free movement and it's more opportunities for everyone because of that network effect. But then if you zoom in, then it's a hornet's nest, isn't it? You know, as you say, there's the cultural aspects alone, but there's obviously the tax, there's the labor laws, there's the regulations, there's the insurance. Yet it seems to be sort of steamrolling ahead at sort of 100 miles an hour. How do you see that the sort of the bleeding edge is going to interact then with all of these cultural differences and the regulatory differences in the world?
I mean, it's a good question. I think you've captured it really well. It's sort of where there's a will, there's a way, and there's such a thirst for opportunity. And you know, you see this in countries where. You know, where there's a very hierarchical, tightly controlled 9-to-5, you know, only take your breaks when you're allowed to sort of culture. The opportunity for someone who's living in that environment where all of the jobs are like that to maybe work for a foreign company which doesn't have any of those controls. Because even, you know, even if you say you've got a society and a lot of people in society believe the same thing or feel it, you've still got a huge variance, right? So there's still going to be people who hate the way that operates as much as there are people who love the way that operates. And so I think the desire to be able to explore greater opportunities and, you know, economically obviously is huge as well. You can't stop that. You can't hold it back. We were talking before and you mentioned that, I mean, how do you police somebody working on a laptop through the internet for a company on the other side of the world where, you know, there's no travel, there's no borders crossed, it's all happening digitally? You can't stop it. You've got to embrace it in some fashion and try and facilitate it. But it's a struggle, I think, from a regulatory perspective.
In the Philippines, I mean, there's a huge gray economy of Upwork, workers, freelancers. Some estimates are around 3.5 million Filipinos are living solely off the gig work of Upwork and freelancing. And look, it's fantastic because a lot of them are out in the province and they otherwise wouldn't have really access to economic opportunities. And it's putting the Philippines on the map. But the downside is that it's and I'm, you know, I'm a free market capitalist, but these people aren't paying tax. They don't have health insurance. Things aren't really being done properly, you know. But I'm just not sure if that's then the bleeding edge. And then over sort of 20 to 30 years, then of course this will become more normalized. It will be regulated, and kind of infrastructure will fall in place. Do you know, what are your thoughts in terms of the the broader spectrum of employment and how, you know, that's going to align globally as we go forward?
Well, I mean, governments are going to catch up, and you know, they've always got the hammer, and the hammer is they can catch individual people at a tax level, and they can catch transactions at a cross-border level. So, you know, money always has to come in through, I mean, I don't know about Bitcoin and all this stuff, but, you know, money has to go through banks. And so, for example, in Australia, any transaction that comes in over $10,000, it gets flagged. There, and there's various, you know, levels of scrutiny that they go through, and with computers and technology, they're getting better and better at it. So, you know, if you're operating in the, if you think you're able to operate in those spaces where it can't be traced or monitored, there'll always be people who stay ahead, and there'll always be governments trying to catch up, and then there'll be people who get caught in the crossfire. I think that for countries who are forward-thinking, you know, and if you look at the Philippines as a great example, what a wonderful economic benefit it is to be bringing that revenue into the Philippines, and what a terrific change from some of the work experience that Philippines nationals have had to go through previously in order to earn a living. And I'm thinking of service workers who've had to travel all through Asia, and sometimes in pretty horrific conditions, be away from their families and their communities, and be doing jobs maybe well below their capabilities because that was all that was on offer. And whereas now you could be a knowledge worker doing a job where you're well recognized and you're doing it from the comfort of your home. I mean, we've got some fantastic people in the Philippines in Shield, and one of the, you know, we've been recruiting there for a few years, and one of the main benefits we found is they don't have to commute. You know, we've had people who were commuting an hour and a half, 2 hours, 2.5 hours each way, each day, and they don't necessarily need a better job. They just need a job that they don't have to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, you know, I'm a huge proponent of remote work. However, I generally think that people function better from an office. And so I've always been a little bit torn, and, you know, I always maintain that as quite a hard line, you know, and if you're going to offshore staff, then it's better to have them working out of a facility. You get better discipline, you get better results. It is a shame in the Philippines that it is just, there is shocking traffic wherever you are in the Philippines. So, you know, it's so common for a 2-hour commute each way, and it is unfortunate. But of course, since COVID, you know, I'm looking like an old fuddy-duddy if I say you've got to work from the office. And it is important to keep with the times and kind of stay modern. So I'm really not sure the best position for that. But do you know, how do you feel, this is a segue, but how do you feel for the younger generation, the 20-year-olds, the 25-year-olds? You know, typically as humans, we learn from social mirroring. We see people, how they act. We see discipline. And if you're a 20-year-old starting your professional career and you're just sitting in your bedroom in your pajamas, how's that going to shape over the next 20 years?
Well, you know, it's a good question. But look, if you're that age, and particularly if you've had tertiary education, I would have said, but even now with COVID, not many people haven't had experience of working remotely now. But we found this before COVID, you know, we were 80% remote before then. And hiring early career folks, hiring interns, which a lot of remote companies weren't doing because they said it was hard to train. I never found it that hard, because if you're bringing someone from school or university, they're used to working in their bedroom or in the spare room or from the dining table. They're used to doing tutorials online. They're used to consuming lectures through their computers. They're digital natives. They actually adopt better than anyone. And they're also used to building their own social networks and maintaining points of connection in and outside of their day-to-day activities. You know, they've got friends, they've got uni friends, they've got friends in other countries where, you know, they just meet on forums or Facebook or video games, or, you know, I'm going to date myself by not naming the most up-to-date ways of connecting. I do share your concern about, you know, I think from our era, you know, if we put ourselves in the same demographic, it was very common that you would have friends from school and then you would go to work or go to further education and you would get new friends. You know, you keep some friends, get new friends. You go into the workplace, you have new opportunities to make friends, to meet romantic partners, to build relationships. And that's all very exciting. It was a great way for people to explore themselves and build new connections. And I feel this now where I've got people who I work closely with who I would love to spend time with. You know, I would love it if our families were able to spend time together and our kids were able to become friends. But you know, I'm in Sydney and they're in the US or they're in South Africa or they're in the UK. It's totally impossible. But I think, you know, as human beings, we're incredibly versatile and resilient, and we'll find ways to adapt.
Yeah, I agree. And humans do adapt, and then there becomes new normals, and it's just not always obvious what that new normal is, but inevitably people adapt, and it just becomes normal, doesn't it? The PEOs, then, if you can speak to PEOs a little bit, what they are exactly. And from my sort of outside perspective, I've seen a rise of PEOs. And, you know, maybe as things become more specialized, it was always historically just assumed that an employer would hire its own employees. But over the decades, employment gets so much more complicated. The liabilities get so much more complicated, so much more technical, you know, requirements. And it's probably too much work for an employer to employ its own people. And so there's these PEOs, from what I understand, and they specialize just in employment. They then have kind of bulk contracts, so healthcare is reduced. Am I getting the right end of the stick? And do you see that as a kind of a solution going forward where eventually most SMEs would be within a PEO?
I think it's an option, you know, and if you think about the ways that people can do work, you've got everything from, you know, you're employed by this company in this country, you know, in this location, you go into the office, like you're totally connected to this particular company. And there's like a line that stretches all the way from that through to pure digital piecework, you know, even beyond the Upworks to things like Mechanical Turk, you know, where there's no connection between where the work comes from and the person doing the work. It's just, it's almost anonymized. And where we sort of sit, where the PEO space sits, is where the compliance needs to be met, but there's a barrier to doing it directly. And so economically, it makes sense to be able to outsource or leverage other people for that. So, for example, in the US, you know, there's all these different states. And if you've got an employee in a different state, sometimes even an employee who travels through a different state, you then get requirements to register as an employer, to pay state taxes, to put them on local social security or taxes and requirements. And that's a massive overhead, particularly for small companies. And that's where the PEO model really came about, because in the US, for smaller organizations, particularly as they're growing, operating in different states was a big barrier. And so there's this model of co-employment, and that's where the employer holds some of the liability and the PEO holds a bit of the state-based liability. And if you take that model, when we apply it in the global context, the biggest difference is it's not a co-employment relationship from a legal perspective. There's a company that's consuming the services and they have a contractual relationship with the employer of record. The employer of record employs the individual person. And so where that fits is basically where you can't employ them directly yet, maybe. Maybe you want to incorporate, but you're not ready to do it. And you don't want to engage them in a different way. So, for example, you don't want to engage them as a contractor. Maybe it's very clear that they're an employee. Maybe you want them, or the employee wants to be treated as an employee. You know, they want to have access to Social Security. They want healthcare. They want to be paying their taxes in a certain way so they can access, you know, schools and so on. And there's this sort of gap, and that's where we fit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's it's a complex web, isn't it? And there's so many different solutions because there's so many different options, I suppose.
Yeah, it's exploding. We've been very fortunate, I think, from a timing point of view. You know, I'd love to take credit for it, but it's just a fluke that the amount of global employment activity is going up dramatically, and there's sort of a progression. And, you know, we've experienced this ourselves. Jessica, one of the folks who's working with us now, is in the Philippines. She started working for us, and we hired her through a website called Task Army, which was run by a friend of mine, and it was basically like a virtual assistant service. And she worked for us as a freelance virtual assistant. You know, we paid her as a contractor. The hours weren't fixed. And over time, we're like, this person is so good. You know, and we built a relationship. The first few years, we barely even spoke, but she was really good at her work, and gradually work got more and more and more. And, you know, eventually we got to the point where we're like, oh, we want to hire her. We want her to work for us directly. You know, she's totally tapped into our culture. She's a wonderful person. We want to look after her. She wants to have that connection with us. And, you know, so this is an internal perspective, but we didn't want her to be through a platform. We didn't want her to be a contractor. We want her to be an employee. And we want her to be protected and supported. And so I think there's going to be a lot of that activity over time where, you know, initially there can be a tendency to view your foreign employees, particularly if you don't view them as doing key roles. You know, if you view it as like, oh, it's like a portable or a cheaper resource that we can access on demand. You know, over time, we're human beings, and we're going to make connections, and we're going to build relationships, I hope. And then you're going to want to treat people differently. You're going to want to have, you know, you're going to realize the value that's there and the additional value that you'll get from greater engagement and connection. And, you know, maybe we're a stepping stone on that pathway.
Sure. And just to explore the broader market, I have heard, you know, of other names in the market now, and I think that's an absolutely fantastic thing because I think the Silicon Valley is starting to shine a light on this. You know, there's Deel, there's Oyster, there's Boundless, there's Remotive, I believe. One of them has been funded by Andreessen Horowitz. You know, do you think that this sort of, you know, the Silicon Valley deity see this as the next frontier?
It seems like it, yeah. It's been a funny ride for us, to be honest, that, you know, there were only – when we started our business, we were one of a handful, and our biggest issue was raising awareness about what we do. And we'd be routinely talking to customers. The thing we would hear over and over again was, oh, I wish I had known about this earlier, you know. Back when we hired people in Netherlands or, you know, 2 years ago when we had this thing in France, if only we had have known about you then. And over the years, it's changed. So I think there's greater awareness of the need. There's greater awareness of the opportunity. And so there's more providers and there's more competition. And the space itself is growing. So you know, I'm really grateful that there's more attention coming in. We've sort of, you know, I think we sort of sit a little bit on the side and benefit from some of the tailwinds that get generated. But there's no question that there's a big demand. I think how it plays out is going to be interesting, because you have this sort of there's a bit of creative tension, let's say, between whether it can be could it ever be like a purely digital delivery, or is it a people issue? You know, is it HR, or is it you know, like payroll software? And I think, you know, that's an interesting question that we find in a lot of areas. You know, I think you could say the same thing about outsourcing platforms, you know, and a lot of other areas, is how human do you want that experience to be? And you know, levels of support and complexity. But, you know, I know Job, who runs remote.com. I know Alex from Deel. I haven't met Dee from Boundless, but I've heard really good things about her. And I know one of the product owner guys at Suraj at Oyster. He's a terrific guy. And so they're all great companies, and they're doing terrific work. I think at the moment we're in a sort of happy families phase where the market's growing enough that everyone's benefiting. Maybe at some point, you know, the knives will come out and we'll get competitive. I don't look forward to that, to be honest.
And do you think then, you know, if you zoom out again, then it just seems sensible to have a standardized employment approach globally? But, you know, that doesn't seem a reality, certainly in the next kind of 50 to 100 years maybe. So do you think that then it is these intermediaries that basically iron out all of the wrinkles and present a standardized service to the client? Do you ever see that there's going to be more homogeneity with employment law globally?
I'm not confident, no. I think the way that employment law manifests is a product of how a society operates. And, you know, you've done your share of traveling, as I'm sure most of the people listening have, and you know how rich and varied the world is. And we see that every day in terms of how employment is treated. And I think, you know, if you went to a country like China and tried to say, hey, work should be more flexible and, you know, employers should have more rights here, you're going to have a tough time, because in China, the principle is every person should have a job, and that's how the legislation is set up. And heaven help you if you try and make someone lose their job without following the right protocols, because it's very important to that society that everybody has a job. And, you know, fair enough. That's their choice. It works for them. And every country has variations of that. I think over time on a lot of issues, there's going to be there will be some homogeneity that comes in. You know, and the EU is a good example of that, you know, where you've got a sort of common legislative framework that you can adapt a bit, but broadly speaking, it's pretty similar. But if you look at how hard it is to get anything done legislatively in that environment, and then you try to say, okay, well, what happens if we took this to the Middle East or Africa or the US? They're worlds apart.
And where do you see this progressing then? Because you sound like you're very exposed to it, and I'm very exposed to it. Just remote work generally. I've always embraced sort of internationalism, and digital nomads are very commonplace to me. Yet we are a tiny niche within a niche within a niche. But do you expect within 20 to 30 years that it will be a norm that you're working for a company in a country different to that company, or you might be, you know, a digital nomad visiting a country and you're doing work for a company in another country, how sort of do you think this will always remain a tiny niche, a tiny fraction of the employment market? And if so, then it doesn't really matter? Or do you think eventually this will kind of spread out to become the new norm?
I think it's going to be in the middle. It sounds like I'm sitting on the fence, but it's kind of like this thing between office and remote, and you have these two sort of tribes or religions, and they're like, oh, office, everything has to be co-located, we all have to talk at the same time, sort of thing. And then on the other hand, you've got, oh, remote, no office, totally asynchronous. It doesn't have to be either of those. It can be a blend, and in fact, you can have groups who decide to park themselves anywhere on that spectrum and say, this is our spot. You know, we want to have a local employment experience where everybody's from Sydney and we all want to work together. We want to go in the office together. And that's how we choose to operate. And those employers, as long as they can attract enough people within that market to do that, they're going to be super happy. And then you'll have other employers that say, we want everybody to be in a different country. We want them all to be working, you know, separately, and we're only going to communicate via Slack. And you know, again, as long as they have enough people to do the jobs that they need to do and the people are happy to work that way, you know, all power to them. The number of people who are going to want to explore variations on that continuum is going to explode and continue to explode. And people, and probably companies, are going to shift between modes as they go along. You'll have potentially, you could see a journey where somebody comes into the workforce and they really want to have colleagues and mentors and be trained by somebody who sits next to them, and they might go into a co-located, localized experience. And then, you know, their eyes come up a bit and they want to explore the world, you know, and it's a common rite of passage in Australia for a lot of people to spend a couple of years traveling. Well, maybe you go take a job with an international company and you digital nomad that experience. So you're not backpacking and working in bars. You're taking your job with you as you go. And then perhaps you settle in one of those places and you localize, or you stay working for your international company. Perhaps you're lucky enough to meet a partner, you have kids, and then actually being at home is super helpful. Your kids are in school, being able to do school pickup like I'm going to do in 45 minutes is something that is really important to you. And so it's that flexibility, you know, it's being able to change modes, and that's possible now. COVID, for all of the wrong that's happened, all the damage that it's done, we went from very few people having experience of remote work, apart from spending a day outside the office when they were, you know, when they were sick or exceptional circumstances, to a huge number of people having worked outside an office for going on a year now. That's no longer an experiment. That's potentially a deep change in behavior. And so the future that I hope we get is where there's more choice, where there's more flexibility around hybrid modes and trying to accommodate everybody. I think it'd make work a whole lot better.
I think that's a great place to leave it there. I think it's an absolutely fascinating puzzle, isn't it, for someone to really figure out and to de-complicate for end users, so that you do have that freedom, that flexibility, the optionality from both the employer side and also the employee side. And then there's the infrastructure such as yours to just dethorn it all and decomplicate it all. It's certainly a multi-trillion dollar opportunity, isn't it?
I hope so.
Thank you so much for all of this insight, Tim. And if anyone wants to reach out to you or learn more about Shield Geo, how can they do that?
So I'm on Twitter at Planet Burgess is my Twitter handle. I'm on LinkedIn. I think it's Burgess Tim is my LinkedIn, or Tim Burgess Shield Geo. You'll find me there. And our website, shieldgeo.com, there's lots of stuff on there as well about what we do and how we do it, who we are.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a great conversation.
That was Tim Burgess of Shield Geo. If you want any of these show notes from this conversation, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. And as always, if you want any of the show notes, go to outsourceaccelerator.com. See you next time.